and welcome to episode 22 of Artist Materialist. I'm Susanna, an artist and graphic designer.
I'm Dan, a material scientist.
And today we are discussing an article from The New Yorker called Treasures from the Color Archive by Simon Scama. And I have to say, it was like you were reading my mind when you suggested this article, because I was just thinking, I would really like to read something about the color, the science of color, and the overlap of color and science, and voila, here we are.
And this is something that I came across, and I was very interested to hear your perspective, as since I haven't really used much paint in my life except the odd watercolor in school, and so I was really interested in hearing your perspective, because I think you've just spent more time with paint than I have. So it seemed like a good match.
Well, it's interesting. When I was in high school and starting to actually use real acrylic paints, I didn't really think much about the names of the colors. You know, this was ultramarine, this was lead white, this was cadmium white, and they didn't seem to be that different. Or I guess it was, we didn't use lead white back then, it was cadmium white. But as I used them, I slowly began to learn a little bit about the different colors and why they were different, why cadmium yellow was different than chrome yellow. I would notice that one was a little more lemony, another was a little more orange. And it, using acrylics, modern acrylics, the colors didn't change and fade quite the way that the ones in the collection described here did, but I was still interested in why they were named that and what made them slightly different. So I find it interesting that what this article is about is something called the Forbes Collection that is essentially a museum of color. And it's a collection of all the different pigments artists have used through the centuries, as much as they can collect them. And it shows what they look like when they're painted, when they're faded, and researchers figure out what they're made of. And some of the compositions of these colors are very interesting, like the one, the red that's called dragon's blood, is actually from a tree that is the Dracaena draco, palm tree, the dragon palm. Not actually from the blood of dragons, like the mythology says, although that's a better story. Some of these are very toxic, and the artist either didn't realize that they were toxic and used, or they used them anyway because they loved the color so much they didn't care.
One of the things that kind of goes with, and specifically the dragon's blood, it talks about how that was shipped from Madagascar or something, and it was interesting that this is a very European centric article. That's where all these paints are. It's the Forbes collection is very focused on the history of European art, although it talks about a bit about what happened elsewhere. But we hear a lot about the spice trade because they were valuable and you could put a lot in a ship, but it seems like along with that is this dye trade, which in the past, I remember way back in ancient history, all this stuff about the royal purple. So I remember that, but the Tyrian purple and that, but all of these other colors, it was interesting that I can imagine that was also a very valuable thing. And some of these things are just crazy, like the idea that there was a mummy brown that was made with real mummy.
I know, and that was all the rage in the 1800s. It's kind of amazing. And apparently they don't use it now, and there was...
I would hope not.
And it does say that they weren't necessarily human mummies. They might have used, you know, the animal mummies to make it, but people were raiding tombs to get mummy parts to grind into pigments to get just that right color of brown. And you're right, the pigment trade seems just as important as the spice trade. It talks about Marco Polo discovering ultramarine blue being used in, I believe they said in China, created from ground lapis lazuli. And that's a color that we still use today, or it's called ultramarine blue. I'm sure it's probably made from ground lapis lazuli. It's a very expensive color.
Yeah. Well, and specifically with that one, I know that's one where it talks about how it was a very expensive pigment, and so that was reserved for the cloak of painting the cloak of the Blessed Virgin Mary in all the religious paintings. And so that's why Mary was always in blue, is because that was the very prized pigment.
Yes, it's interesting how scientific and economic forces have influenced our perception of art and religion there.
But with
And
that is particularly one where it fades. And I know that that's an issue with lapis lazuli, is that various of these minerals in particular, if it's not in its lowest energy form, then if it's exposed to the elements, it will fade. And that it's not just the mineral itself, but also the binding agent that it gets put in can have a real effect on how long the color lasts.
yes, and one thing that the Forbes collection does is it shows what the colors, the various pigments look like when they're combined with binders, for example, egg white, egg yolk, whole egg, and what was the third one?
I think it might have just been oil or acrylic.
Oil. Yes, oil and acrylic. And that was something I always thought about related to Vermeer and other of his contemporaries, using that black mixed with egg white to make perfect thin black lines that later fade to brown. But I hadn't really thought much about the using other parts of egg, and about too, when we talk about acrylic paints or oil paints, that is oil mixed with pigment, acrylic, a plastic substrate mixed with the pigment,
Yeah.
if you really break it down.
Yeah,
And
and
I like the story of how the museum or the collection came to be, because it was about this man Forbes who, in order to better understand art history, decided to try and better understand how the paintings were made and what they were made of.
really, you see a lot of efforts to combine art and science, and sometimes they can end up being a little bit of a formality or sort of a little bit cute, but this really was very deep.
Yes. And I find it interesting that he originally, Forbes originally started studying art history in depth so that he wouldn't be cheated when he went to Europe to buy artwork, so that he would know what was real and what was a fake and what was quality and what was junk. And
Well,
really, we do that nowadays too. I mean, it talks later in the article about how some paintings thought to be by a painter who died in 1959 turned out to have pigments in them that didn't exist until the 60s and 70s. So they knew that they couldn't have been by him.
so what with switching gears a little bit. The one of the other things this brought up, which kind of goes with the world trade aspect, is just the sheer amount of toxic labor, toxic exposure that went not only to the painters, which is kind of famous. You have there's just the story of Van Gogh and how he didn't realize how toxic the paints he was working with were. But on the other hand, you have the people who were making the pigments and were just untold number of people who probably got very sick from making a lead-based white paint.
Yes, he talks about the slaves who had to mine cinnabar or harvest indigo, and the women who had to process the lapis lazuli or stand there in the horse manure, which was what was used to produce lead white to get the lead to flake for the pigment. One thing that I've known about since moving to South Carolina is one of the most important early crops for the colony, South Carolina, was indigo. And indigo was more valuable than cotton, really, for South Carolina for a long time. And the purple dye was prized. And there's also a particular kind of seashell, a purple seashell that makes
Is
a
that,
really beautiful purple dye
I
here
think
in
it's
South
the
Carolina.
cochineal, right?
It's not, no, it's not that one.
Okay, it's a different
It's a
one.
pen shell.
Okay, so this is particular to South Carolina.
Yes, or this part of the East Coast. And you can still find them. They're very pretty purple color, and they can be ground up to make a purple dye that's very unique and dark.
And which goes with this, it talks also about the chemical revolution, and as somebody who's studied chemistry, the production of synthetic dyes really was considered one of the early great successes of synthetic chemistry. And it talks a little bit about William Perkin making mauveen, which is a purple dye that was made from coal tar, made from a petroleum substance. And I had heard that story before because it's very much a one of the big stories of chemistry, but it was interesting how it had its separate boosters, and there was sort of a religious aspect to it almost about how wonderful it was to create beauty from the muck and also all the other colors that were also of great interest, because it wasn't just the expensive purple, but also all these horrifically toxic other kind colors, which are not toxic in the modern sense, which is kind of used loosely, but really, based on heavy metals or arsenic, which is something that there's been some other recent articles about how you have to be careful with old library books. If they have a green color, it might be from.
Yes, the article describes that hotel room, or I guess it's a room in a hotel that is covered in green. And they said that if you stay in that room too long, the fumes from the arsenic and the green pigment could make you sick. And so, it says George Field in England, the man from the Industrial Revolution who's figuring out how to make other colors out of coal, basically, talks about how he thought of himself as a reformer. He's trying to replace the old toxic pigments with these new, safer pigments.
Before we
And
move, go ahead.
we're still doing that to some degree. Actually, we're still doing that today, trying to recreate the old pigments that we've seen in paintings, but using new materials and new science.
And I think that's one of the things with this Forbes collection that they're really trying to do is having these samples that have been kept away from light, being able to recreate it from something that hasn't faded, as opposed to just if you just look at a painting in say in a museum, you might think that they always painted Mary with a very faded cloak, because it's not nearly as blue now as it once was.
Yes,
And
that's the benefit of having the pigment itself and not just the paint on the canvas.
Well, in terms of the stories of particular colors, I think we can't skip one of the ones that they talk a lot about, which is this Indian yellow.
Yes, that seems to be one of the focuses of this particular article, an Indian yellow that is a particular sort of light yellow that was used to make the glints in gold. It was used to make the sunlight in the sky. If you look at William Turner's paintings, he used that one a lot. And it's also one that is mentioned as being one that Rembrandt used as well.
And so part of what this article does is it sort of goes through the detective work of the detective story of trying to figure out this Indian yellow. And they aren't sure, but the idea that it's from this very sort of alchemical process of force feeding mango leaves to cows and then collecting their pee is
Yes. And refining it into
and
this
refining
yellow
it,
color.
yes. That's
Well, and the fact that it was believed to be an apocryphal story, nobody thought that could truly be real. It had never really been proven. And of course, as the article mentions, once there was a man who was sent to India to figure out how they made this, and when he saw them feeding the mango leaves to cows, and told people about it, the other Indians were horrified because cows were sacred and feeding them the mango leaves was making them sick. And so the people who were doing that were told not to do it anymore, and so the color disappeared. And at the end of the article, they get some validation by finding some old, original, unprocessed Indian yellow. That this is actually how, probably how they made the color was by refining the pee of cows fed mango leaves. And so, to some degree, you kind of have to wonder how people came up with that idea. I mean, you can kind of
I, yeah.
understand the lapis lazuli. You see a pretty rock or the green malachite, you see it and say, wow, that is an amazing color. Let's grind that up and make it into a paint. Do you look at, did your cow accidentally eat some mango leaves and you say, wow, look at the color he's peeing. That would make a nice pigment.
Hey, you know, an artist's eye, right?
That's right. Have you ever been to the, well, I know you've been to the Gem and Minerals collection at the Smithsonian.
I have. It's been a while since I was paying attention too much to it in particular.
I visited it again recently this year, and I'm just struck by the amazing colors in nature and the amazing variety of minerals that exist and that we have named and classified. It's so much more than me, a non-geologist, would have thought. And it makes me think about what possible pigments you could make from all of these amazing colors. I mean, it's very often when you see some sort of strange color, we'll say, oh, that's a color that's certainly not found in nature. But looking at that gem and mineral collection makes me realize there are so many colors. Every color is found in nature somewhere.
Well, that was something I wanted to bring up was that so this is very focused on the art of painting, specifically in the European tradition. But all the talk about the minerals made me think about sand paintings in particular, like Tibetan sand paintings, or I think there's also a version that's in American Indian traditions also have something maybe similar, but where it's not a process of grinding up something and putting it into a paint, but you just really just going out and finding just classifying sand in some cases. You just find the sand and just divvy it up by color, and you can get all sorts of colors that way.
Yeah. Did you get to see the Tibetan monks when they visited York High School to create the sand mandala in the chapel?
I've seen it when they visited. I've seen it in other places, but not that one, I think.
Yeah, it's okay, so you've seen them working on it. It's a really interesting process to watch as they create it, and it doesn't really look like sand, like you said, the because of the colors that are in there. It's it's just sort of a pure color. And I guess that's the difference, mixing the pigment with the dry bind. It's not really a binder, is it? It's not
No, and that,
binding
well,
it.
that's right. Well, that's and that's the thing is that, and it, when at the end, when they kind of sweep it all together, then it then you're like, oh, that looks like dirt. And so it's the sort of the reverse engineering of that that you take out, you separate it out, then you can, in some cases, have a lot of different colors.
And since the sand mandala is intended to make you think about nature and the impermanence of life, that's very apt that you would take this ordered thing and sweep it all back together into chaos, sort of into its primordial state.
Well, in terms of from an art perspective, I thought that the project that they were involved in was just really incredible in terms of the, it was this Khandakar with the Strata Center, where they were doing a projection of light as sort of a non-contact temporary restoration of original color.
Yes, that was fascinating. So apparently Rothko, the famous Mark Rothko, the famous artist, painted a mural at Harvard, and the pigments that he used and the place where the mural was, it just faded. It was on a wall, it was in the college, just the wear and tear of everyday life and atmosphere and light degraded it, and it was removed in 1979 because it was so badly damaged, and they couldn't figure out how to restore it so that people could see what it originally looked like without, using the same pigments again, which would degrade again, which wouldn't really show you what it looked like. It would kind of, they said it would sort of make it muddy or change the colors if you put the same color on top of the existing color. And so they figured out how to put the murals up and use light to project onto them at different intensities to make it look like it used to when it was first created. And that's a, like you said, a really interesting application, but also an interesting application of colored light and pigment color. And that's something that I've always been fascinated by. Studying digital art, that's something that I've had to think about a lot. That's one of the first things that I learned when I started studying graphic design was you have to be aware of the difference between pigmented color and light color and how the two are created differently, because when you're designing things on a computer screen, you're seeing color created from light, and when you print things out, it's ink, it's color created from pigment, and the two are not exactly the same. And so there are various ways to make sure that what you see on the screen becomes what you get printed, but they're very different. And so using light to restore a painting is almost going the opposite direction some degree.
Yeah, and just it, I imagine that would it was a very intensive project to go back and forth between what you, they're trying to add and how that interacts with what's already there. And so I imagine there was a lot of iteration about getting it just right. And but I thought that was great just from the perspective of the sort of ethos of conservation, of art conservation seems to be whenever possible, try to do something that you can undo in case you it turns out you did it wrong. And I think that's more about restoring really old paintings, but it's really I find it really interesting this idea that you can restore something extremely temporarily by just shining light on it.
And in a way, that is sort of, like you said, the least damaging thing you can do to the work of art so that it's restored but not damaged. Earlier on in the article, it talks about how Forbes, the man who created the collection, when he was looking for art to buy in Europe, he kept coming across these old works of art that had been covered in varnish to preserve them. And of course, the varnish had yellowed and ruined the art. It could be removed, but very with difficulty. And so he began studying how to conserve and restore art. And that took him even further into the study of pigments. I really liked the description of the class that he had, where he taught students about how colors, paintings, paints were made, and he had them paint on the wall of his house so that they could learn what the different pigments looked like on plaster and get some hands-on experience with that. I would have loved to have been in that class.
That does seem like a very cool class.
One thing I discovered is that the Forbes collection has a pigment database online, and I'll provide a link to that. It's the Forbes Pigment Database, and you can search the different pigments organized by color: white, black, yellow, brown, orange, red, violet, blue, and green. And you can see, for example, if I look up vermilion, it tells you all the different vermilions that they have in the collection, from cinnabar to Chinese vermilion to scarlet vermilion. And I think that's really interesting if you want to look up the different types of colors that people might have used.
Yeah, it's really, to me, it's fascinating, just especially all of the colors, because just in my material science life, I run across white and black a lot, and in the modern day, that's almost always that means white almost always means titanium dioxide, which is now is very readily available and not toxic. I mean, probably even if you have a pill is white, it's probably from titanium dioxide, and all the way through your house paint, it's the same white. And black is very, very, very often just carbon black. It's, basically soot. Whether it's that's what people are making black cocktails out of. And again, it's if there's black paint or black ink, it's very, very commonly it's just going to be this carbon black. So everything else is very exciting.
I didn't realize people were making black cocktails out of carbon, but they're making black ice cream out of charcoal, so I guess it
Well,
makes sense.
that's it's the same thing. It's the
Okay.
charcoal.
Oh, yeah, that's carbon. See, yeah. That makes sense. It's funny how fashion dictates what colors are popular and the search for different colors. It talks about how in the 1800s, people really loved their browns, and money brown was all the rage. And then at one point, earlier than that, everybody wanted different blues and purples, and so they were using the shells, the indigo, the ultramarine. And now there seems to be a search for this, or recently there's been a search for blacks and making the blackest black and making things black that shouldn't be black, like ice cream or drinks. It talks a little bit in here about Vantablack, the special nanotechnology, blackest black pigment that has ever been made, and how one particular artist managed to copyright it and bought it so that only he could use it in his artwork, and how that made other artists angry.
Well, with something like that, it's there's a very practical, very scientific. From that perspective, the blackest black just means the thing that reflects light the least, which you can imagine has all sorts of technological applications.
Yes, it would be great to put on, anything that you wanted to be stealthy or anything that you wanted to be cool.
Or hot, depending on the situation.
True. And oh, reflects light the least. Yes, why was I saying cool? It'd be hot. It also mentions Yinmin, the blue that was in the news a few years ago. That's the blue color that some chemists at Oregon State University sort of invented by accident when they were trying to build some electronics stuff, and they mixed some chemicals together, some oxides, and it came up with this amazing blue color. And I know you looked at, there was another article about the bluest blue. Was that about the Yinmen, or was that about other
That was
blues?
so that was about an artist who's working in collaboration with some researchers at Berkeley on an entirely different kind of blue, which is based on quantum dots. And because there's different ways that you can get color, and we've been talking about minerals that are based on the chemical composition, but there's a whole other category. And I don't know if it talks, it may say a little bit in this article about you can also, if you have certain butterfly wings and certain stained glass, it's really, if you have particles that are small enough, they end up interfering with light in a way that can create color. It's really exactly like a or not exactly like, but it's a little bit like a rainbow. No, it's not.
I know that cosmetics have been using that effect, the butterfly wing effect, to use little tiny particles to create interesting colors, for example, in eyeshadows.
I'm su a little surprised that they've. I guess they must have found a less toxic way, because the quantum dots, at least for now, are still mostly made out of some pretty toxic things. There's a lot of cadmium, but if you have something that's small enough, you end up having these quantum effects that result in it being colored. You can use the same compound to make any color. Just you make it a smaller and smaller particle. But that's really bad. It's not really bad, but it's hard to make a paint out of that, because then when you have particles that are that small, they want to stick together, and then they don't do that anymore.
So I guess you would, I have more of a powder that coats things as opposed to a semi-liquid that you spread on things.
Well, the other article talks about sort of their how the special thing is that they're developing a binding agent that can let it still do its quantum dot thing. Whereas, if you have a butterfly wing, it's a flat surface. So it's really laid out all on a plane. And there's even some quantum dot based televisions. And those are also, or work on similar effects, and those are also it's you use electronic processing so that you have everything just in one plane. You don't have a depth of paint.
Well, I look forward to hearing what they come up with in their color research, or seeing what they come up with, I guess I should say.
Yes, and I guess with all of this, it points to the importance of sometimes you have to see art in person to really get the full effect, because otherwise you're really just seeing the colors that your screen can project, which is not the same.
That's true.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Artist Materialist. Please visit us on the web at artistmaterialist.com. Please rate, review, and share with your
With your color-loving friends.